Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Oh, yes.
Right,
I thought it was too low. Nice.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Stuck in.
What's that?
Tag stuck. Oh, hopped up.
Let's see if we can get a good shot.
Good one.
Ari Friedlander is a professor of ocean sciences at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and he's with us now. Welcome to the show, Professor Friedlander.
Thanks for having me.
So which one are you in that little bit of sound that you just played?
I was the one at the end. The other person you could hear is my colleague, Chris Johnson, who was annotating us deploying a tag and collecting a biopsy sample from a humpback whale in the Antarctic.
A humpback whale in the Antarctic. Okay. So so you were, which part of the Southern Oceans were you in?
So most of that research is conducted on the western side of the Antarctic Peninsula, the area south of South America.
Okay. And what exactly were you doing trying to tag humpback whales there?
Yeah. So part of our long-term project is to deploy these, what we call biologging instruments that give us feedback on the behavior and the movement patterns of these animals. And there are different types of tags that tell us about more or less kind of detail about the behavior of the animal, or they stay on for longer or shorter periods of time. And in this case, we were putting a tag on that whale that we hoped would last for several months that would tell us about the position and the movement of that animal between its feeding grounds and then as it migrates up towards its breeding grounds in the tropics.
Okay, so I have been in the Southern Oceans only once in my life, and it was kind of a harrowing experience, actually. So are you, are you like in a little raft, a little dinghy? Are you in a big boat? Like, are you head to toe in foul weather gear? What is it like to try to get up close to a feeding humpback in Antarctica?
So what you're hearing is like the very, you know, the last 5 seconds of what is, you know, probably a 2-week journey just to get to that point. We fly down to South America, we get on a large ship, we cross the Drake Passage, which, as you know, can be a pretty daunting piece of the ocean, and you bob around and you just keep thinking, oh, it's going to get better, it's going to get better. And then magically you wake up one day and you are at the coast, and all around you are just these magnificent glaciers and peaks and icebergs, and somehow it all feels calmer. And luckily, the Antarctic Peninsula has a lot of very sheltered bays that are surrounded by these mountains. And that's where the whales like to go and feed. That's where they rest. And so we take the big boat in there, and then we get into, a very small boat that's about 15 feet long. And we're dressed like you would kind of be for skiing, except we try and be a little more waterproof. We try and find a few whales, and hopefully they're willing to let us get up close to them and we can deploy our tags.
Yeah. So I promise you we'll talk in much more detail throughout the hour about why you're exactly what you're trying to discover by tagging these whales. But it's just, you know, this is a moment for us to be transported to a completely different way of experiencing the world. So you sent us a little bit more tape of some of your tagging adventures here. Here's another moment where you and your team are out on the water.
Get ready, Dave. Throttle stuck on me. Did you get him or not?
Heads up.
Good hit?
Not a good hit.
So we heard there, I heard, you know, the sort of rush of rising water and, of course, the whoosh of the whale's blowhole. Is that right?
Yeah. So, you know, to put these tags on, we've got to get pretty close to them, probably about 10, 15 feet away from them. And so when the animals surface, generally we hear that blow or we can see them at the surface and we try and creep up to them very slowly at an angle. And then, you know, it's about timing our approach to them as they surface. And it's really up to them whether or not they're disturbed by our presence. And if we can kind of be a fly on the wall behind them, we sort of sneak up on them and then we deploy the tag, coming in as slowly as we can. When you hear me kind of revving the engine there, sometimes what the animal has actually stopped in the water, and to stop our momentum, you have to go into reverse a little bit, because you don't want to, you know, get right on top of the animal. So it's a bit of a dance, and understanding the behavior of the whales and kind of what they're doing and what they are likely to respond to helps you get closer.
And sometimes the throttle gets stuck, as we heard.
And sometimes the throttle gets stuck, yeah. And actually, that whoosh of sound that you heard was probably we generally tag the whales when they're going down on a dive. And sometimes if the animal responds to us, like it gets startled by a tag touching its back, it'll flick its tail a little bit. And so oftentimes we might get a little bit of a shower from the Southern Ocean.
So how big are the humpbacks that you've tagged?
They feel really big. I'll tell you, the first emotion that you feel around these animals is small. These whales are probably 40, 45 feet long, and they weigh about 30 tons. So they're, you know, twice as long as our little boats. And these are the medium-sized baleen whales that we work with.
Okay. I love that. I mean, I think all of us as human beings occasionally should be in positions where we feel small in comparison to nature's wonders here, but let's give you credit. You have successfully tagged several whales, and here's one of those moments again that you sent us where you had better luck.
Maintaining course.
I got that old whale. All right, just sit here for a sec. Perfect driving, man.
The cheering threw me a little bit.
Yeah, so that was a special circumstance.
Okay.
So, you know, getting to the Antarctic is a bit of a challenge, and we kind of go by any means necessary. And one of the ways that we as researchers have found that working in the Antarctic works really well is to collaborate and partner with the tour industries, because these are ships that are making routine trips down there. And if we can offer our science as a value added to what the passengers are experiencing, it's a win-win, because we get to talk about our science, we have a captive audience, and then the tourists benefit because they get to see what we're doing and take part in something that's pretty unique. And so in this case, we were working from a tour platform, and the specialness of that one was that this was a species called the Antarctic minke whale, which is endemic to the Antarctic. You know, it's only found in these icy waters, and we've never tagged them with our video recording tags. And there was one curious minke whale that was circling this large large tourist boat. And so we went out, and all the passengers were on the railing, and it was a bit of a theater, and I was a little nervous with all those eyes watching us. And so luckily we got the tag on, and yeah, you can hear all the other expedition folks pretty excited about that.
Yeah, including the guy who says in the distance, "I got that on film."
Yeah, we've got about 70 different angles of that deployment. Yeah.
On the other hand, though, I think people, like, you know, lay people ought to also see how the hard work of science involves coping with a lot of failure. But we are here to actually talk about a success, I would call it. That's the culmination of what, 30 years of collecting the kind of data that I presume you get when you're tagging all sorts of species of the world's whales. It's called Protecting Blue Corridors. So can you tell me what is that, Professor Friedlander?
Yeah, so you're right. It's a culmination. It's an aggregation. It's a synthesis, and it was a product, a report that myself and a number of colleagues who collaborated with the World Wildlife Fund put together to try and showcase, hey, look, there's been a huge amount of research that's gone on around the world to deploy tags on whales in all of these kind of independent places and independent projects. We now have an opportunity to put all of that information together in one place and get a global view of what we know about where whales go. And not only where they go, but where these corridors are that they migrate through from their feeding grounds to their breeding grounds. And then on top of that, think about the things that we do in the ocean as humans that put these animals at risk and try and show visually where these threats occur, the types of threats that these animals face. And by visualizing that, I think it gives us a much better perspective on the type of conservation or management that we need to consider to protect these animals, not just in the places where we see them when we're on a tour ship or when we're in the tropics, but along these routes where not a lot of people tend to interact with them.
Yes. Okay. So I've been waiting all week to be able to say the following phrase on the radio, Professor. Whales have superhighways?
They do. You know, so many species of whales migrate from high latitude feeding grounds, where in the summer there's a lot of food and they put on a huge amount of weight in 3 or 4 months. And then they migrate to an area in the tropics that's much warmer, closer to shore, a bit calmer. And that's where they give birth and where they breed. And they migrate along what we call these superhighways, where if you deploy enough tags and you get enough data, you see that they all take the same route. And they're all using a very kind of narrow band of ocean pretty rigorously. And to us, this really represents, you know, the culture of these animals, their ability to migrate and to use the ocean in a way that we don't understand quite well enough yet, but they certainly do. And there are these places or pathways that are really important to them to get from point A to point B.
Mm. Well, folks, we have to take a quick break here, but in that break, I would like you to hop over to onpointradio.org, where we have a link to the Protecting Blue Corridors report and a map as well of these whale superhighways that we're talking about. Take a look at what Professor Ari Friedlander and his colleagues, again, have been spending decades trying to understand. Where do whales go? How do they migrate? How tight are those corridors of ocean that they rely on? And how much overlap is there between those corridors and areas of human disturbance? We'll talk all about it when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about whale superhighways in the oceans of planet Earth. And a new report titled Protecting Blue Corridors, out just this year from the World Wildlife Fund, that collates essentially or gathers together 30 years of data that scientists have been collecting about the migration patterns of the world's whales and where they go, what they do, and how much that strongly overlaps with human activity. I'm joined today by Ari Friedlander. He's a professor in ocean sciences at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He co-authored the Protecting Blue Corridors report, and I should say that it was a collaboration of what? Some 50 research groups, Professor Friedlander?
Yeah, organizing the data, like you said, I think it was over almost 850 tags over 30 years. We wanted to ensure that, you know, all the folks who participated in collecting these data had an opportunity to be part of this report.
Yeah, including, I see, the University of Southampton, and I just have to say, I've got to give my alma mater a shout out, and Oregon State University as well. So let's talk a little bit more about what you discovered. First of all, what were the species of whales that helped, through the tagging, help provide the data for the Blue Corridors report?
Yeah, that's a great question. Most of the species that we focus on are the baleen whales, the largest whales, blue whales, fin whales, gray whales, right whales, bowhead, humpback. These are the ones that have the baleen that hangs down from the top jaw and that engulf these massive, you know, volumes of water and push it out and eat very tiny krill or fish. We also included sperm whales, which is the largest of the toothed whales in here, because there's a lot of great data on their migratory patterns as well. So it was, while it represents everything we know about these eight species, there are a lot of other species that we really just don't have any information for.
Mm, okay. So I'm looking at the map right now. And I mean, there's lots of different kinds of behavior and migratory patterns we can talk about. Let's just start sort of in the Western Hemisphere, right? So you had sent us that sound of you collecting or tagging whales off the Antarctic Peninsula. I see that's an area of very, very high whale activity. And then there, you're right. It like looks like a highway. This orange band, very tightly defined orange band, then goes north, just hugging the coast of Chile, essentially, right? And Western South America, all the way up to Central America. Tell us about that little corridor there.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So these humpback whales feed on the western side of the Antarctic Peninsula. They probably arrive there in December or January, and they stay down there until probably April or May. And then depending on the conditions, the animals start to migrate and they move north. They go through the Drake Passage. They leave the Antarctic, you know, from a number of different places, but they all kind of coalesce into this really tight and narrow corridor right around Cape Horn. And then, like you said, they hug the coast of Chile. They go up the coast of Peru and then Colombia and Ecuador into Central America. And it's really a very well-defined corridor that these animals use, and how they're communicating with each other along that route, or whether there is some information that they're able to glean about the environment that tells them where they are on that route is really a question. But the answer is that they do it.
Yeah. And on the western coast of Mexico and North America, we see the same thing. Those are blue lines. There are different species we're talking about.
Yeah, so okay. Off the western coast of the U.S., there's been a huge amount of effort to study blue whales. Uh-huh. And we're very fortunate to have a pretty good-sized population of those animals that migrates from the coast of they go all the way up to sort of southeast Alaska sometimes, but they forage from there all the way down to Monterey or even into the LA Long Beach area. And then those animals will migrate south along the coast of Mexico. Some of them go into the Sea of Cortez. And then their ultimate destination is an area called the Costa Rica Dome, which is sort of this offshore area from Central America where we think those animals give birth and breed. And then they migrate again right up along the coast there. And that puts them in a lot of proximity to shipping, right, and things that we do in the ocean close to shore.
Right. Because, you know, the coasts are where the people are, essentially. A lot of people, as we rely on the oceans for transport, food, et cetera. So the food is really, is this what's driving the whales' migratory patterns? Because I'm looking at basically that entire western shelf from Alaska all the way down to Antarctica, and that's this giant coastal upwelling zone, right, which is great for marine sort of nutrition.
That's exactly right. That's a really insightful point, that these western boundary currents on the western side of South and North and Central America are great habitat because you get upwelling of cold, nutrient-rich water along the coast in a lot of different areas. And, you know, in an evolutionary sense, these are the kinds of things that allowed baleen whales to evolve. And so they're taking advantage of the oceanography in these areas. But again, that puts them, like in Monterey Bay where we are, you know, we have blue whales 2 or 3 miles offshore. We have humpback whales right along the beach. And those foraging areas put them in harm's way. Mm-hmm. And you can see along the coast where the blue whales are that there's an awful lot of places where they feed. And because they are so big and they have such big energetic demands, they likely have to roam pretty far to find enough food, you know, from month to month or year to year. So their ranges are pretty large.
Right. And across that range, these whales come into contact, perhaps not directly with humans, but with human activity, as you said, because it seems like such a strong overlap between where these whale superhighways are and, as you said, where fishing, human fishing occurs, where shipping occurs. And so that's the entire point, how closely related the needs of the whales are and the needs of human beings are. And the conflict that produces, or the impact on the whales. So Professor Friedlander, hang on here for just a second, because we did talk with a variety of marine mammal experts who have been focusing on the impact of human activity on whales. One of those impacts is noise, the noise that we're making underwater. So Carrie Sager is a bioacoustician. She studies bioacoustics, let me put it that way, at Applied Ocean Sciences. And she collects underwater sound to better understand its impact on whales and other marine life. Sager uses a couple of different kinds of hydrophones to listen in on the world's sea life. Some of the waterproof microphones are bottom-mounted, anchored to the seafloor off the coast of Mexico or in the Arctic for as long as a year. She's also got some that she just tosses over the side of her boat.
It's a hydrophone that you just dip over the side and you let hang over the side for as long as you want to listen. I usually use those if I'm trying to record a humpback whale song.
Sager says for marine mammals, sound is sight, and that sound travels far.
When you're thinking about how far sound travels underwater, it can travel for across oceans. If it gets into the deep sound channel, it's going to be from Boston down to Australia.
And all along those thousands of miles, there's a mass of human activity.
So ships is the one that's the most pervasive. Sometimes it's really hard to be like, oh, that's ship traffic noise, because it's just general background from like several shipping lanes. Because if we're buying something on Amazon and it's getting shipped from another country, it's probably on a container ship. So like whatever traveled to my door was on a trip that made sound in the ocean. There's other ones that I think are less obvious. Pile driving. So every time you've driven across a bridge that's not a floating bridge, right, that has the big spires, the piles, if you're in 50 meters of water or less, you're going to be driving a pile with a big hammer on a huge ship, just smashing it into the ocean floor. That is very loud. Mapping the ocean. If you're USGS trying to map the bottom of the ocean so you can figure out where underwater volcanoes are and fault lines for earthquakes are, that's all done by sound.
So, all of these underwater noises, Sager says, put together, they're a painful cacophony that gets louder and poses a greater danger to whales every year.
If an animal loses its hearing completely, they're just like us. We're mammals. We can't see through the water. Light waves don't even travel very well through water. You know, they're very limited in the distance that they can see. So sound is vital. It's how they're going to find, you know, their mate, their pod, their calf, hear a predator and know to get away from it, know that there's land they're about to run into and avoid that. All those life functions. So if you're deaf, life functions are pretty much out the window if you're a marine mammal. Even if you're temporarily deafened, or like your ears, you know, that equivalent of your ears ringing, it might make it harder to find food for that day. What if it's a continuous thing where every day you're having a hard time finding your food because there's some activity going on making your ears ring? Then you're just not getting the calories that you need to survive. Or you're not able to hear a predator when it's about to come up and attack your calf. And if that calf's a North Atlantic great whale, there's like 336 of them left. Now there's 335. And the one that died is a female of reproductive age. Then you've just lost an animal in a small population that would have otherwise potentially repopulated the species. We don't have a good grasp on all of the variability between individual whales of effects. Like one whale may not be disturbed by a boat passing while the other one freaks out. Same way that we are as humans. Like someone might be cool sitting in the coffee shop having the train go by every 5 minutes, and one person, it may just stress them out to the point that they'll never go back to that coffee shop again. So yeah, I think like anthropogenic noise is an accepted phenomenon. And now we're trying to figure out how bad it is, in which places, and what's the first kind of mitigation to do? Like, is it shipping lanes? Is it small vessels that get close? Is it whale watching? Is it overfishing? Like, what is the biggest stressor? And that should be the one that we tackle first.
Carrie Sager, she's a bioacoustics researcher at Applied Ocean Sciences. Professor Friedlander, I keep going back to what Carrie Sager there said about how far sound carries in the oceans. She said it can carry from Australia to Boston?
Yeah, there are parts of the ocean that are conducive to carrying sound very far. And if it's a loud enough and a low enough frequency, there have been experiments that have shown that you can hear sounds across ocean basins. And the bigger the animal, if we're talking about whales, the lower frequency the call and the farther that sound travels. So we know, for example, blue whales, you can hear a blue whale call, you know, several hundred miles away if you're listening in the right places.
Wow. And so do we know if these human-generated underwater noises are, in fact, interfering with whale navigation, with their stress levels? I mean, how much do we know about what happens to them when endless numbers of, container ships are motoring by?
Yeah, like Carrie said, you know, really eloquently in there, there are things that occur momentarily, and then there are things that can be chronic in these animals. And you can habituate to a sound, or you can be sensitized to it. And the impact that has on you physiologically, the amount of stress that you have because of that, can really impact animals. And there have been a lot of studies that show at different scales, when there's more sound in the ocean, that animals have to expend more energy to communicate. Like, think about if you're in a loud room, you've got to talk louder to be able to get, you know, to communicate with somebody who might be very close to you. And so you're using more energy to do that. Another consequence is you may not communicate. You may be like, hey, it's too loud in here, I can't communicate with that other animal. And for animals that are social and that either feed cooperatively or live in social groups, that kind of lack of communication can have a huge impact on social structure and social bonds and on foraging. And these animals aren't like us where, you know, if you miss a meal, you can just go to the cabinet and get a snack. These animals are sort of working at a physiological knife edge where they can't afford to miss meals very frequently. Otherwise, an individual's fitness will go down. And if that means that it doesn't reproduce as frequently as it would have otherwise, the opportunity for that population to grow is going to decrease.
Mm.
There are chronic as well as immediate impacts
I see.
Of sound.
You know, today I was trying to understand exactly what that must feel like, because I happen to walk to work every day, and my walk takes me through a pretty urban area where there's an above ground trolley, there's obviously car traffic, there's construction, garbage trucks, etc. And it has reached the point where, like, I can definitely say the sound stresses me out. And I'm actually thinking about getting some kind of noise-canceling headphones for my ears for my walk to work. I mean, is that analogous to what the whales are experiencing?
100%. You know, we are doing work right now to try and quantify the relationship between sound in the ocean and stress hormone levels in whales. And so we collect little skin and blubber biopsy sample from these animals, and we can actually measure cortisol, just like we have in us. That's a good representative of stress in these animals. And what we're finding right now is that, for example, the population of humpback whales in the Antarctic, where there is very little human noise, it appears that their baseline population level stress is pretty low, but animals off of Cape Cod or off of Monterey Bay have elevated levels of stress. Mm. And those are places where there's a lot more human activity.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk about how other human activity is having an impact on the world's whales, especially again as these whale superhighways so closely overlap with parts of the oceans that humans use extensively. So, Professor Friedlander, stand by for just a moment. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about whale superhighways. Now, these superhighways have been recently mapped in a project called Protecting Blue Corridors. It's from the World Wildlife Fund, and Ari Friedlander, professor of ocean sciences at the University of Santa Cruz, is a co-author of this report. And Professor Friedlander and colleagues of his from a lot of institutions around the world took decades of tagging data from whales that had been tagged and have created a map of these whale superhighways and the narrow corridors that the world's whales use year-round and rely on for feeding, for breeding, for health. And we're talking about exactly what the human impacts are along those very same corridors. So Professor Friedlander, hang on here for just a second, because we talked about the acoustic impact of noise from shipping and pile driving. There are obviously other impacts on whales, and Michael J. Moore is the person we turn to talk about that. He's a veterinarian and scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and he's spent the last 40 years researching whales, particularly the North Atlantic right whale. Now, this time of year, the whales are coming back to Cape Cod Bay, and just a few days ago, Michael Moore was out on a boat using a drone to document returning whales. And that's when a North Atlantic right whale Moore hadn't previously known came right up to the boat.
We were able to follow the whale with the drone, just watching it underwater, swimming around and underneath the boat too. So we got some really nice photographs, and some with the boat in the same picture and some not. Now it just blew on the left side. It's a small whale, maybe 30 feet long, a year or maybe 2 years old. And I'm taking a close look now at its callosities with all the whale lice on it. And its head is sticking out of the water at a fairly sharp angle. And you can see the baleen hanging down from the roof of the mouth. And You know, the swells have dropped down. It's a couple of hours before sunset, and now the whale's leveling out a little bit. It just blew. Now I can see a little bit more of its back. It's a little bit further away from the boat now, and now it's turning right again, doing a sharp turn, so it's now parallel with the boat. And it'll come back in towards us again in a minute, probably, if it does what it's been doing for the last 20 minutes or so.
There are less than 340 North Atlantic right whales known to be alive today. Humans are the reason for their dwindling numbers. In the past, of course, with whaling. And in the present, entanglement in fishing gear and vessel strikes. Those are the prime culprits. Back at his office at Woods Hole, Moore explains that more than 80% of right whales have been entangled in fishing gear at least once. A quarter of them get entangled every year.
What they are is usually some kind of rope that the animal has swum into inadvertently and wrapped around various body parts. And so the rope can get wedged in the baleen, which is the horny material that hangs down from the roof of the mouth that they use as a filter for feeding. And often it can get wrapped around the upper jaw a number of times.
Moore remembers one whale in particular, Bela, who was entangled. After sedating her, Moore and other scientists were able to remove some of the rope, but it wasn't enough. She eventually died.
The rope had cut down into her right lip to the point where it had healed over. And so if you cut into the lip, this is during when she was dead, not during the necropsy, the autopsy, you could see the rope embedded in her lip. And she was, the rope then was going from the lip to being towed behind the whale. You know, think about it. All this weight pulling on your lip day after day after day. As a veterinarian, it makes me cry.
Over the past couple of years, scientists, technologists, and fishermen have developed so-called ropeless gear. It's tech that eliminates the need for vertical lines that run between, say, lobster traps on the seafloor and their buoys on the surface. So whales getting entangled in coastal fishing gear could be a thing of the past, but Moore isn't sure it will be.
It's a conversation that has in some ways shifted from science to economics, culture, politics, and what we really care about. Do you want your seafood affordable? And obviously the survival of the industries and the human costs of what this means to the families involved in that industry versus the long-term survival of the biodiversity of our oceans and what these animals mean in terms of ocean health. What do we care about? Is ultimately the hard question to answer.
Back out on the waters off Cape Cod, Moore watches his new acquaintance, that young North Atlantic right whale, as it moves around the boat. And he gets pensive during a brief moment of simplicity and peace.
It's hard to know whether it's feeding or it's curious or a bit of both, but it just blew again, its mouth's open. Tilting up its head, now you can see the rack of baleen on the left side and the right side as it just comes through the water. Some folks have described this as the seventh wonder of the world, and it's quite extraordinary really that we have these animals within 5 miles of fairly major, you know, housing and people and railroad tracks and highways. And here we've got something that's been here for hundreds of thousands of years, just quietly doing its thing. And it would be so nice if they could continue to do so that humans can live and the whales can live. And it's now coming right very back close to the boat again. Most extraordinary situation here.
That was Michael Moore. He's a veterinarian and whale scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and also author of a book called We Are All Whalers, The Plight of Whales and Our Responsibility. Also, we really want to note that Michael Moore is a researcher and therefore able to get close to whales for purposes of research because he and his fellow scientists hold permits, critical permits for the work through the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Without a permit, North Atlantic right whales must be given 500 yards of distance. So you would be breaking federal law if you tried to approach these whales. Don't do it. Don't do it. Let that work be done by the scientists and researchers trying to help the whales. Professor Friedlander, you know, Michael Moore there said, these animals, these whales, what do they mean in terms of ocean health? So what do the whales mean for ocean health?
It's a good question. I was really taken by what Michael was describing there. You know, there clearly is this heuristic value that whales have, and the connection that people have to them is quite visceral and it's quite emotional. But beyond that, whales are indicators of ocean health in a couple of ways. You know, because they're so big and because they require so much food, the presence of whales in an area really indicates that there are processes that are happening in the ocean to provide enough food. So there has to be a healthy, functioning ecosystem for whales to be able to thrive there. But more so, we're learning more and more that ecosystems in the ocean aren't these linear things that sort of end at the top predators, but whales sort of complete a circle because when they eat a lot of food, they defecate a lot. And one of the things that they do is they recirculate iron back into the marine environment. And in many marine systems, iron is a limiting nutrient that plants and phytoplankton in the very basic units of life in the ocean need to grow. So by having whales in an area, you can actually help to fertilize patches of the ocean that can help to increase the amount of plant life and growth that eventually becomes the food for whales as well. So more whales means they're eating more, but they're also recycling and fertilizing the ocean more to help stimulate growth.
So I keep going back to the map that's in the Protecting Blue Corridors report. And again, folks, go to onpointradio.org to take a look at this map and also read the report as well, because it's so clear. I mean, the power of a visualization is quite immense that the whales strongly rely on these corridors that are absolutely, there's like a one-to-one correlation between the whale's use and human use, right? And we talked about the western coast of North and South America. There's a bright corridor between, is that what, Hawaii, between Hawaii and Alaska. And then all of the paths that the whales use between, let's say, Antarctica to Africa, to Madagascar, to Australia, to New Zealand, and then from the Arctic down. Now, in the United States, we have the Marine Mammal Protection Act. There are some international treaties about whales, but the waters that these animals rely on don't really necessarily, they don't recognize any international law, right? So the animals will move where they need to. What do we need to do now that we have a better understanding of the areas of ocean that they rely on?
Yeah, that's one of the critical points of this report, is that these animals, and this has been shown in several publications, can move through 7, 8, 10, or 12 different international sort of territorial waters throughout their migration. And if countries are not cooperating and all kind of working at the same level of conservation, then the risks are not equal. And so, for example, with North Atlantic right whales, where Michael was saying that ship strikes are the thing that these whales suffer from, or entanglement in fishing gear. Well, if one of the countries that these animals move through doesn't make a change, but the other one does, the risk is still there for the animals. And so once we understand the overlap and the risk, there needs to be better cooperation, collaboration, communication between countries that have differing levels of protection, because it literally is kind of a weakest link here. You know, if the weakest link in the chain is going to have the highest amount of impact on these animals. And as long as that's there, the threat is still there for these animals.
You know, Professor Friedlander, though, you list in the report all the the obstacle course, as you call it, of human-created challenges that the whales have to navigate as they just go through their annual migratory paths. Chemical pollution, plastic pollution. We talked about underwater noise, mining, oil and gas. I just have to read all these. Construction, overfishing, ghost nets, bycatch, ship strikes, some commercial whaling still, and of course, climate change. So where would you start, though? Carrie asked this question earlier when we talked to her about acoustic pollution of the world's ocean. Where's the most feasible and productive first step into protecting what these corridors are?
It's a great question. And I don't think the answer is the same around the world. I think you really have to look at each species and the areas that they're going through, finding out what exactly those risks are. And I think we're pretty good at being able to tell what risks are likely to be direct, like a ship strike or entanglement in fishing gear, and what are likely to be chronic, like ship noise and some other things that we do in the ocean, plastic pollutants. And so I think you need to take an approach where you identify the greatest risk immediately, and like Carrie said, you kind of work down from there, because it may be that you can remove 80 or 90% of the risk by minimizing one or two of them. And that would be a great place to start.
Mm. Well, we've got about a minute or so left, Professor Friedlander. How long have you been researching whales?
You know, I was a junior marine biologist very back in the day, you know, when I was a kid. But I got my academic start with whales when I was an undergraduate in college. So, you know, 25 years mm-hmm. ago.
Do you remember your first real life encounter with one of these great animals?
I do. It was in sixth grade, and it was on a whale watching trip out of Cape Cod. And I remember seeing humpback whales and immediately thinking, what the heck is that? How is that so big? And what is it doing?
and then how do you feel every time you're able to get closer to them now as you continue the research that you're doing?
I'm still in awe of these animals. I have a very strong emotional connection to them. I feel an obligation, you know, for myself and my colleagues and our students to do things that help these animals to survive and thrive, because I care about them. I care about them being here for my children and for the sake of the oceans.
Well, Ari Friedlander, he's a professor of ocean sciences at the University of California, Santa Cruz, co-author of a new report from the World Wildlife Fund called Protecting Blue Corridors. And as I mentioned, we've got a link to the report and an image of those whale superhighways in the Protecting Blue Corridors report at onpointradio.org. Professor Friedlander, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.